listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
You know, your ideas about how your own brain works are likely outdated. Time for us to move past the many generalizations about how the brain works, including the idea that our right brain is our artistic side and the left brain is the seat of logic, each side working separately. And especially if you're creative or want to be, today's exploration of how your own brain works will help you unlock the keys to your creativity. My guest today is science writer Ransom Stevens. Welcome to Full Power Living, where we're helping the world to realize and work with the importance, power, and mastery of human emotions. We welcome your questions and comments. We have chats on blogtalkradio.com and on our radio show page at emotionalpro.com. And you're invited to call us toll-free, 888-498-0570. That's 888-498-0570 to talk with me and Ransom Stevens. Now, Ransom Stevens is a physicist with a PhD. He's a science writer and a novelist, and he's written hundreds of articles on subjects ranging from neuroscience to quantum physics to parenting teenagers. His new book, The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, a look at the neuroscience of innovation and creativity in art, science, and life, is an accurate, irreverent, underscore that, look at neuroscience for a lay audience with emphasis on innovation in art, science, and life. He's given thousands of speeches across the U.S., Europe, and Asia, and the reputation he's developed is for making complex topics accessible and funny. You can learn more about him at ransomstevens.com. That's ransomstephens.com. So, Ransom Stevens, welcome to Full Power Living.
Well, thank you very much, Eileen. It is wonderful to be here.
Great. It was cold last night where you are, huh?
Well, it was for us. You know, it's just below 50 and people start freaking out.
Well, to help us understand our brains, let's start with the three developmental parts, our frog brain, our puppy, and our, how do you say them, phenomen?
Richard Feynman.
I didn't pronounce it correctly. Tell us what these parts of the brain are and what they actually do.
So this is a metaphor for how your brain works rather than a model. I derived it from what is called the triune model of the brain, which is an oversimplification. Neuroscience is a brand new science, and so it is riddled with oversimplification. And will be for a few more decades until we peel a few more layers off of our understanding. But here's the basic idea. Our brain evolved over, 3-4 billion years, depending on how you're counting. And the first part, which we share to some extent with reptiles, is usually called the reptilian brain. I prefer calling it your inner frog, because I think lizard brings on too many connotations. So the part of you that maintains your breathing, your breath rate, your heart rate, your perspiration, certain immediate, very, very immediate reactions, and your balance, your ability to dance and move. You think about it, standing on one foot is really quite a feat, but, you know, we do it with one foot, so hey. So that's your inner frog. Your inner puppy is the center of your brain. It's called the limbic system. And it's got your amygdala, which is your 4F center, the part of you that decides whether you're going to fight, flight, freeze, or mate. For the most part, your emotions, this is where you feel love and fear and hate and anger. Though some of that bleeds off into your inner frog, too. It is an oversimplification. And finally, the newest part of our brains is what I call the inner Feynman. This is your neocortex, that thin, wrinkly gray layer around the outside, and this is where you do your planning. And the reason I call it your inner Feynman is because Richard Feynman was the greatest American physicist in the 20th century, an amazing guy who figured out relativistic quantum physics and made it possible for mortals like me to understand it, you know, if I went to college for 10 years. So he's the guy that does your quantum mechanics up there. That's where you do that. But each of these three parts of the brain are tightly networked. And we share the frog, your inner frog, with all of the animals that wander around on two or four legs, your inner puppy with all of the mammals, and in a different sense, but pretty much equivalent with the birds. And then the neocortex, well, the dogs have one too. It's just smaller. And the biggest brain, of course, is the sperm whale, which has by far the largest brain of any animal on Earth.
And I note that you have a whole discussion about what exactly that means, the size of brains and so forth. You know, I hadn't really thought of it as too much as I was preparing for this show, but I lost my husband this year, and he worked for 47 years as a brain surgeon. And so I had the opportunity to go into the operating room and observe him do 4 brain surgeries. And the brain is kind of an unusual part of our body. It doesn't do a lot of bleeding when you operate on it. And the other thing that you bring up that I'd like you to talk about is that our brains themselves don't actually have nerves.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny because nerves are what communicate the information from the rest of our body into our brain. And they're called the neurons. And they've got an axon, which is this really long, sort of think of it as a wire that goes down and detects things. But inside our brains, we have about 80 billion of these things. And they're much smaller, of course, than the ones that feed down our spines to our toes. But, yeah, we don't feel pain in the brain. You can poke around in there. The surgeon can do brain surgery on you. And you can be perfectly conscious with just a local anesthetic where they, you know, cut into your skull. And you won't feel any pain, which is kind of funny, right? I mean, if you could feel pain there, then when you had thoughts, you would probably be able to feel them in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a pretty weird thing.
Yes. Well, I do remember following a patient with my husband and being amazed that 2 hours after the operation, they could be lying in their bed having a perfectly normal conversation. You know, it's not like a physical operation where it really takes a long time to put things back together again. So you also talk about bottom-up parallel processors, about how the brain works. We've got the axons and neurons and the dendrites and the neurotransmitters and all of those things. That's the physiology of how it all works, or the mechanics.
The gooey parts.
The gooey part, the wet brain. But what are, for our listeners, what are bottom-up parallel processors and how do they relate to our consciousness?
So here's the cool part, right? There's all this physiology. In my book, The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, I don't spend a lot of time, a tremendous amount of time with the bits and pieces and the jargon. But the cool part, to understand how your brain works, is, you know, can be done in normal language, right? So here you go. Think of it like this. Our brains have far more going on in them than we're aware of. And here's an easy example. Picture someone you love. A child is a really good example, if you have a child. If you don't, picture somebody else you love. Now, when you come into a room with this person, really what's happening in your brain is first, there's a bunch of light reflecting from this person, and that goes into your eyes. It bounces around in there. The signal goes down your optic nerve to the back of your brain, and it starts assembling an image. And you are not aware of any of this, thankfully, because if you were, you know, it'd take a long time to get anything done. So your eyes, the optic processors in your brain construct this image, but at the same time, you have the sense of smell and sound, you hear them talking, and once your brain starts combining all of this information from simple auditory sound images to visual images, and then into this person. And then you start getting hit with the emotional impact because it's someone you care about. And so all of this happens very, very quickly, and we're not aware of it. All we're aware of is, hey, here's this person I love. So the point being that there's a ton of thinking going on in your brain that you're not aware of. And that's what I call your bottom-up parallel processors. And individually, you know, individually at a very small scale, they don't do much. But combined, they do everything that you are. So, what am I aware of, and how does that come up? And that's a very good question, which, of course, can't really be answered. But it can be speculated on. And here's the thing. So from the top down, if we have these bottom-up processors, certainly we get thoughts. We're conscious of things. We have thoughts that we're aware of. And these are conscious thoughts. And we are capable of being aware of something like 3 to 7, maybe 10 concepts at once. Even though we got millions and millions of things going on in our brain. But so 3 to 10 of these boil up, and we're aware of them. And that is consciousness. So we've got this sort of unitary sense of self that you can think of as coming down, as sort of boiling up of all these possible thoughts, and then just a few that we're aware of so that we can be a unit, a person, and have a feeling about who we are and who others are.
So let me just clarify that. Thank you. That helps. The bottom-up parallel processors include things like what we believe. Would that be so?
Yeah. Well, this is the feedback, all right? So what we believe is a combination of how these things boil up and then how we're aware of them and what we think of them. Mm-hmm. So we can program our bottom-up parallel processors with our beliefs. At the same time, those beliefs pop up and can reinforce themselves or be contradicted by other thoughts that boil up, and then we change our beliefs. But there is a tight loop between, you know, our conscious thinking and the thinking that we're not conscious of. And to try to – this is the thing about the brain, right? We're trying to figure out brains by using brains. So there's already, you know, there's picture within a picture feeling. And pretty much every time in neuroscience that you want to separate things, that you want to separate like nature and nurture or talent and skill, you find that they're really not separable. They're tied up in a feedback loop, in a knot, where one affects the other and the other affects the one and so forth. And that's certainly true with what we're conscious of and what we're not conscious of, including beliefs, opinions, and everything.
Right. Well, I've worked as a psychotherapist for the last 44 years, and one of the things that I see myself and other people struggle with comes from what you talk about of us humans being pattern recognizers and model builders. And you talk about the power of the first experience in something. We tend to actually live most of the time in the past because we take our past experience and apply it to the present. And we can get lost doing that. So talk to me about this problem that we have that's based on what our brains are like.
Yeah. So in order to make sense of the present, right, and to be sure, all we really have is this instant and then this instant and so forth. Our awareness really spans about 1 second, about the time between heartbeats. But it sure doesn't seem that way, does it?
No.
And so we build up a context of what the present, of what's going on in the present from the legacy of the past and all of our experiences in the past and all of the patterns that we recognize. And so we are pattern recognizers in the sense that when we see something, we have to identify it as fast as possible. Because if it happens to be, say, a saber-toothed tiger, we're going to need to realize that at least as quickly as the saber-toothed tiger realizes that we are food.
So we
tend to jump on, and natural selection selected the humans who made very quick, very fast, and not necessarily very accurate assumptions. We recognize patterns, whether they are there or not. But those patterns come into developing what we see as context. And that gives us then our sense of continuity from the past into the present, and then, of course, we are constantly predicting the future. Now, the thing about first impression is that, well, you know, we all know this. First impressions, you only get one chance to make a first impression, and they weigh heavy. And the reason they weigh heavy is that there's very little cost in terms of survival and the ability to procreate between being able to survive and have sex if you make a wrong first mistake. If you make the wrong first mistake, you're done. But if you make the wrong, if you err on the side of caution every time, if you're negative in your first assumption, and you run away from the rustling in the grass, and then discover that later, well, it wasn't actually, it was just the wind, it wasn't a saber-toothed tiger, that doesn't cost you anything. So we tend to weigh those first impressions much heavier than we might want to in those moments when we think of ourselves as rational, reasonable beings, you know, when we're trying to partake in civilization.
I see this issue as sort of a challenge in parenting, because we parents have had, I say, an experience many times over, and we've built up our pattern, and it's difficult to realize that our children are just playing this way for the first time, and it's hard to keep our minds open on that. Would you have any comments on that?
No kidding. I got to tell you, I'm a little bit intimidated to try and postulate about raising humans with somebody who's, you know, studied psychology for 44 years, but I'll try.
it's been trial and error, so we're on the same precipice here.
Well, it was my personal experience as a parent, and my daughter, she's 30 now, but it was my personal experience, and I've observed this among my friends, and then when I started studying neuroscience, I started to see. It's not being completely convinced of the science behind it, but see a path, a trend toward the notion that we tend to parent the child that's not really that kid right now, because children are so dynamic. They're changing so quickly that pattern, that model of the person that we have in our minds is almost always outdated. And so when the kid says, "But I'm 10, and you say, "Yeah, I know you're 10, but you really don't. You're still parenting the 8-year-old. Right up until there is some cataclysmic event, until, you know, they do something really stupid, or they get sick, or, you know, there's something that forces you to reload, to go back and really look at the child and see where they are, and then you get caught up, and then you start falling behind again.
Mm-hmm.
And so that does fall right back into this concept that we are pattern recognizers and that we don't necessarily evaluate everything as thoroughly as we might want to, that it's much easier and faster to put things in categories and say, "Oh, this person is that. This table is round, and that ball is round, and they are all round, or they are round." And so we have these categories, and we pile them in there, and, you know, they're stereotypes, and we all do it. That we are all prejudiced. We have to prejudge things, because if we try to judge things in the instant every time, well, our ancestors would have been saber-toothed tiger food.
Right, right. Very quickly, very quickly. Well, we're up to our first break. Ransom, call us at 888-498-0570 if you have questions about the functioning of your own brain. And when we come back here on Full Power Living, we're going to find out why we tend to lose our creativity as we age. We'll be right back.
Do you know that emotionally, children form the foundation for their life during their first 7 years? Most adults just repeat that early emotional learning, good or bad, over and over for the rest of their lives. If you want to give your child an opportunity to live an emotionally masterful life, then join me, Eileen Dillon, also known as the Emotional Pro, for a free one-hour teleseminar on what it takes for your child to become an emotional master. You'll discover important things like what emotions are designed to do for us. Four things it's vital for parents to tell their children about emotions, and the single most important thing to do when someone is feeling emotion. Register now at RaiseIncredibleKids.com. The time has come for us to allow emotions their rightful place in our lives as the tools and helpers they're created to be. Find out what you need to know in order to give this vital information to your children so they can live emotionally masterful lives. Go now to RaiseIncredibleKids.com for your free Emotional Mastery Teleseminar.
Welcome back, Willpower Living. Let me remind you to call in now to talk with physicist, science writer, and novelist Ransom Stevens, 888-498-0570. Next week, we pause here at Full Power Living to celebrate Thanksgiving Day. We wish you and your family, your loved ones, and everyone you are near or that you help or that you care about a fulfilling and gracious Thanksgiving. We'll be returning with our next show on December 1st when I talk with Stan Goldberg about loving, supporting, and caring for the cancer patient. So many people are diagnosed with cancer these days that this show will offer a lot of help and support to you if you are a caretaker, a friend, or a member of the family. So join us on Thursday, December 1st at 9 a.m. Pacific. In fact, we've got many wonderful shows scheduled for you, so go to our homepage on emotionalpro.com, click subscribe, and we'll put you on the list so you get notification of our upcoming shows. Remember that you can listen to Full Power Living on our archives at both our broadcast locations, Blog Talk Radio and emotionalpro.com, and you can also subscribe to our broadcasts on iTunes. Well, today I'm talking with physicist, science writer, and novelist Ransom Stevens, author of The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs. We're talking about how we see the working of our human brain now that so much research has been done on the topic in recent decades. So, Ransom, before we dive into our regular questions, what's the most amazing or interesting thing that you learned about how your own brain works when you were researching and writing this book?
Yeah, well, there were a lot of illuminating moments, you know, and some of them just really beat up long cherished self-assumptions that, yeah, so I always thought of myself as a rugged individualist, you know, that I made it all on my own. Thank you, State of California, for paying for most of my college education since I was poor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that sort of thing. And, boy, there is a pile of evidence growing about just how deeply interdependent we are as human beings. And that was kind of a shock to the system. The other one, I still find a little bit embarrassing. You know, as a Raider fan, Raider fans aren't usually thought of as being meditators, but yeah, meditation, that's good for you, it turns out. And there are lots of really good reasons that, you know, you can exercise your brain just like you can exercise your body, and it kind of goes in the opposite direction that you want to calm it down. And it makes you more creative. It has decreased. I've been suffering migraine headaches for over 40 years, and it's decreased the frequency of them by about 15%, and the severity of them, they usually last 3 or 4 days. They're down to 1 or 2. And these are statistically significant, by the way. I've been keeping the statistics for 2.5 years, so I have enough to say if you're keeping score, I got a 4-sigma effect going. So this is not purely anecdotal, though it is not exactly a controlled test. But so, yeah, writing this book, it had a huge impact on my self-awareness and the way I live my life.
Wow,
I still go to Raider games, though. I'm still in there yelling obscenities.
I hope you don't have a migraine right after.
Oh, man, I tell you, that's the worst place to get one.
I have this theory that we have sporting events in order that people can release the energy of their emotions. And
no question, yeah.
That's what the screaming is all about. I think, and it's good for us. So You know, you have a whole, I loved your writing about, I think it was bees or ants, but you know how one individual is selected and treated like a queen, and by golly, she becomes a queen. And that was all, as you were talking about, the rugged individualist thing. How are you seeing it? What did you learn that persuaded you of how interdependent, how deeply interdependent we are?
Well, it's an accumulation of a lot of evidence in a lot of directions, but it goes back to I can just prove that we're massively dependent on each other pretty quickly, but it's kind of dry, so let me do it very quickly. And that is, first of all, we build our models of the world. All of our experiences are derived from our senses, from our five senses: sight, sound, smell, taste, and tactile sensations, touch. Now, you could add balance if you want. We perceive everything we know, everything we feel, everything is ultimately derived through our interaction with the world. Okay, so, all right, well, that's me, I'm independent. But then your genome, everything that you physically are, emerges from then the experiences of all of your ancestors. So right out the gate, you are dependent on everything, you know, everyone who came before you. And then your experiences are built on other people. So it starts to get thicker, though. And here's where it starts to really get thick, is that about every century, there are about, 10 to 20 people who are discovered who are essentially raised by wolves. In a few cases, actually toddlers who managed to survive until they were 3 or 4 and then found in the wild. In more cases, some creepy, rotten jerk kept them separate, and they had no human contact. And in every case, these people end up spending the rest of their lives trying to learn a language. And they succeed eventually, but they never develop social skills. And so they can never, they're never economically independent. So in that sense, economic independence is actually defined by social dependence. So there's your proof. But it goes much deeper than that. The neuroscience evidence goes to simple things like when you suppress an emotion, there's a certain part of your brain that seems to, that activates in the jargon of the functional magnetic resonance imaging. It activates.
Right.
There's a certain part of your brain that lights up, that you use when you think of yourself, when you suppress an emotion, and when you think of other people thinking of you. And so we start to get this feedback loop about our self-perceptions and our perceptions of what other people think of us. So here you go around another one of these pictures within a picture where, a lot of who we are is built up by a lot of what we think other people think we are.
Right.
So, it's stunning just how little we can exist independent of others, and not just physically, but emotionally and intellectually. And the other thing, the simplest one is education. Before, for animals, no matter how smart, animals that can't communicate, they have to learn everything themselves. But you, every one of us, from K to 12, those 13 years of education, we acquire the knowledge of hundreds of thousands of years of human experience. Bang, right out the gate, Can't even drink yet. You already acquired the knowledge of 100,000 years.
Wow. That's impressive. That's interesting what you say. Many years ago, I gave a series of lectures at San Quentin Prison in the San Francisco Bay Area. And a majority, this was a pre-release program, people who were about to get out of jail, and they were doing pretty well. And a majority of them were in because of crimes they perpetrated when they were made fairly young, because they were on drugs and they had been doing drugs maybe from the time they were 11, 12. But I noticed that they were on drugs. So they kind of missed their socialization from about 12 to 14 or 15. And it was really clear to me that they didn't have a way to make what they missed. And it sounds very similar to what you're describing there.
Yeah, it does sound kind of similar.
Yeah.
It does, yeah. That's way out of my realm of expertise.
Well, you remind me.
Adolescence, it's so dynamic, right?
Right. Right. Well, now, you offer that the left brain is not totally the logical side and the right brain's not totally the big picture side, but they do work together to help us get where we're going. And I'd like you to share with us and overall go into your right brain and tell us the big picture on how this works, will you please?
Well, since I'm right-handed, the odds that I can speak from my right brain are less than 1 in 100. If you're left-handed, they're up to 5 in 100. But so here's the deal. Back in the 60s, this concept came into being that the left brain is logical, is your inner accountant, and the right brain is your inner artist, is more creative. And the way that came about was at least partially due to the observation that neurons in the left side of the brain inhibit neurons in the right side of the brain. And when that is somehow turned off, that certain creative skills emerge, like the ability to draw pictures that are less stick-like. So that was, you know, it's a big old oversimplification, and it survived, and there's a germ of truth to it, but it's time for a new and improved oversimplification. And that oversimplification, and the thing is, you know, neuroscience is brand new. They've only just had real experimental techniques, real hardcore measuring techniques that aren't just behavioral for 20, 30 years. So it's still very new. Everything is going to change. So, you know, when I say this, there's evidence for this, there's evidence. It's usually not conclusive. But for this, there's a lot of evidence, but it's still an oversimplification. And here's how it works. Your left brain is the one that focuses in, that zooms in on the small details. And so in that sense, it's your inner accountant. It's looking at the numbers. And when you write something, you're writing it through your left brain. When you speak, for most of us, you're using the left side of your brain. When you are fantasizing, when you start stepping beyond, right, when you start writing about or deluding yourself, that's your left brain. So your fantasies, a lot of your creativity really is coming from your left brain. Now, your right brain, on the other hand, is the thing that watches out for inconsistencies. It sees the big picture. So when your left brain is noodling around in the leaves, your right brain is watching the whole forest. So your left brain might be climbing a branch or zeroing in and with a magnifying glass looking at the cells of a leaf. It is your right brain that is watching out to see if there is a bear coming around the tree that's going to eat you. So it is in this sense that your new and improved left-right brain oversimplification is that your left brain is a fascinated child and your right brain is an indulgent parent.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see. That's a really I like that simplification. And that brings us to the issue that you also talk about in The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, which is that children are more creative than adults, and it's our brains that make us so. How does that work?
So, right. So the thing is that we become experts as we get older and our brains mature. We also grow, right? We become experts at things. And when you're an expert, and expert, the word expert and the word experience are, of course, kind of the same word. But once you're an expert, then when ideas come to mind in your field of expertise, and when those ideas come to mind and they won't work and they're wrong, you throw them out. Of course you throw them out. They're wrong. But sometimes when we're working on something that isn't quite our area of expertise, similar thoughts come to mind and we throw them out. And not only do we ignore these ideas that might be brilliant innovation, not only do we ignore them, toss them out consciously, but we toss them out before they even make it to consciousness. right? This goes back to your bottom-up parallel processors and your top-down consciousness, that our expertise trains our whole brain about these idea prejudices, these assumptions about what will work and what won't work. Now, a child doesn't have any of that, right? A child, right, the old joke about, well, it's hardly a joke, but how does a child get experience? By having bad experiences, right?
Okay.
The only way you learn to make good decisions is by making bad decisions.
Right.
That's not completely true. We have schools to avoid a lot of that, and parents hopefully can do that too. But the point being that when you're an expert, the world looks smaller because you can throw things out. So in order to put two very disparate concepts together, and we don't know a lot about innovation, but one thing we know for sure is that innovation tends to occur when we take some expertise from one field and apply it to a completely different field, when we experience lateral thought. And to do this, we really need to turn off, shut down that idea prejudice and listen to all of the ideas we get, even the really stupid ones. Because among all that noise, there is a signal. And so you can increase your ability to innovate, to create, by quieting your mind. But before that, you have to do the hard work of analysis. It's another loop. It always is.
A loop on top of a loop. You're reminding me, we had Anat Banyal on the program. She studied with Moshe Feldenkrais and has her own movement method. And I went to a lecture of hers one time where she had mostly older people and in the audience. And she taught us that if we would give our brain something new to look at, we could actually extend the range of motion in our bodies, because the brain would get excited about something different than what it usually encounters.
Novelty. So, yeah, novelty plays a huge role in all of this, in creativity and just even what thoughts we're conscious of. We go back to this little model of the, you know, I think of it as a percolator model, where we have all of these thoughts that we're not conscious of. And if we think of those as boilers, as water boiling in a percolator, then the consciousness is the water that makes it up to the top and drips down. So we have 3 to 7 of these conscious thoughts and thousands and millions of unconscious thoughts. But the ones that will tend to become conscious are those that are novel. If we recognize the pattern without having to think about it, there's no reason for it to make it to consciousness. But if it's new and different, then it will tend to pop up. And that is actually more of a right brain process than a left, because the right brain is the one that's looking out for the whole forest. So if there's something new, then it will tend to latch onto it. So that actually is the root of the, you know, that's how humor works. A joke is told by having a story that goes along and then takes an absurd turn. So that's the title of my book. The left brain tells the joke. The left brain speaks. But it's the right brain that gets the joke, that recognizes the novelty in the punchline. And then, well, the title of my book is The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs. But it really should be The Left Brain Tells the Joke, The Right Brain Gets It, and the left brain actually does the har-har of the laughter.
That's great. I just went through that process. Right this minute, I'm very aware of it. All right. So we're up to our second break, Ransom. We're talking today about how our brains work with the author of The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, Ransom Stevens. And when we return, we're going to be looking at 5 keys for unlocking your creativity. You're listening to Full Power Living. We'll be right back.
You and everyone you know have been born to learn. All humans are on Earth to attend school. People know this intuitively, but they don't really live by it. And now you can. I'm Eileen Dillon. Born to Learn is the title of my latest book, available at emotionalpro.com. The result of 30 years of investigation, which gives you the big picture and the instruction book. Born to Learn gives you information you need to turn your problems into puzzles and then solve them. life is kinder when we complete our homework assignments. Start today. Order Born to Learn at emotionalpro.com and get a leg up on your life.
Welcome back to Full Power Living. My apologies. If you're joining us, my guest today is physicist, science writer, and novelist Ransom Stevens, who's the author of The Left Brain Speaks and The Right Brain Laughs. Now, Ransom, especially because I'm interested in emotion, you report that we can't separate intellect from emotions. A lot of modern writers are reporting that emotions come from our thoughts. What's your own biggest learning about emotion as a result of your research?
Well, there's a couple of things. And, you know, I've said a few times that neuroscience is new and everything, you know, all of the results are preliminary. Well, not all of them. And this is one of them that I really am quite confident is going to survive the test of, you know, of centuries of research, that what we know and how we feel are deeply, deeply connected. Our inner puppies have our inner Feynman's on a leash. It goes the other way. And here's the thing. So this is work that was originally done, well, I don't know, I mean, it was done by a lot of people, but the person who did a great deal of it was Antonio Damasio at the University of Southern California. And it is the emotional component of reason, and it's really easy to understand. And it comes down to this: in order for you to know something, you have to believe that you know it, and to believe that you know it requires a feeling. We all have this where you solve a puzzle and you get the feeling that it's done, that you've solved it, right? We know things to be true, and that is tied to this feeling of knowing. And so it is another feeling, and without that, we're just accumulating facts and not putting them together. And, you know, whether we believe them or not, we'd be in a constant state of befuddlement. So, yeah, emotion, though I would hesitate to say that emotion comes from thoughts, because everything comes from thoughts, but I think I'd be careful saying that it's just top-down. That feeling comes from understanding. I think that it's tied very closely together. A lot of our feeling, you know, we have instincts. So trying to separate the instinctual from the learned is better left to the experts, I guess, and probably not to them. You're not going to separate them. You're just not. They're so tied tightly together that our feelings, you know, our feelings about the world come to a great degree from how we perceive the world, and that comes from our genes. But it depends on where we grow up. Everything depends on everything. It's a loop, but it's that makes it all the more fascinating. But what we know, it requires emotion.
Well, I've been kind of puzzling about this because I've been working on emotional mastery for probably 35 years, and you know, I know that emotions get connected with thoughts, but the emotion of loneliness, for example, my learning is that when you feel lonely, you have more energy going out than coming in, and if you just start bringing more energy in, the loneliness disappears. So it's not necessarily a thought, it's also an experience. And so I appreciate your feedback loop idea. Now, before we end the show, I want to make sure that give you an opportunity to talk about the five things we can do based on what we're learning about how the brain works to rekindle that sense of childish exploration that we talked about. And before we developed our restricted brain ruts as experts or as experts in life, i.e. adults, and so you have things that we can do, and I'd like for our listeners to have a chance to know what those are. The first is to cultivate a resilience to failure. Will you talk about those, please?
Sure. Here's how it goes. Here's your tutorial on how to crank up your creativity engine. And it goes like this. We all face. Let's pretend that we are Michelangelo, and we're looking at a great big chunk of marble, and we want to carve somebody. We want to carve something, and we want it to be big. We want it to last. We want a legacy out of this work. This is it. This is our masterpiece. It is a challenge. And you're looking at the marble, right? You got a bunch of chisels and hammers. And the thing about chisels and hammers is, if you hit the wrong piece of rock, it's not like sketching with a pencil. You can't go back and erase. You only get one shot, so it's intimidating. But if you don't have some resilience to failure, you're never going to start chipping away. All right? So there's this interplay between stress and confidence. And by saying that you should cultivate a resistance to failure, what you really need to do is to avoid putting yourself in positions where failure is going to kill you. And by kill you, I don't necessarily mean literally, but depending on your own internal, you know, how you deal with stress, you don't want to put yourself in a position where it's so stressful that you can't think. You do have to start chipping away at the stone. Mm-hmm. So the thing to do, and here's what you got to do. So you stare at the stone, and you think about all of the components of this problem, whatever challenge you face. You just fill your brain up with as much detail about it as you can. You do the analysis, but you do it in a way that is not judgmental. Think of it as just filling your brain with all of the knowledge that you have access to about this challenge. Just pack it in. Don't worry about the solution now. The solution is going to come to you. You are going to solve it. Need a little bit of confidence there. And so that confidence takes us to this concept of getting into the zone. So you fill up your brain, all right? And in order to fill up your brain, you also want to prime yourself for success. You want to convince yourself that you can do it. But, you know, that point where we're most engaged in life, where we're really absorbed in a problem, is when we're fully engaged in it. And so if you think of your comfort zone as your chair, you know, a very comfortable chair, well, that's your comfort zone when you're leaning back in that chair. Now, when you're out of your comfort zone, you've fallen off the chair. Where you want to be is at the edge of your seat, where you're fully engaged, and so engaged that the rest of the world kind of falls away, right? That's when you're really at your best. That's when we tend to be at our best. Athletes call it getting into the zone. Lots of psychologists call it flow. So now you're filling up your brain like it's a bucket, and you're just piling information into it, all right? So once you've done that, now you need to go away. You need to go and do something else. So, Eileen, where do you get your best ideas?
You know, when I'm gardening.
When you're gardening, yeah. Yeah. I get them in the shower. I get them at rock gigs. I get them at, you know, even football games. I remember I was standing in line to get a beer at a Raider game. I had to get out my little book and write down an idea that just came to me, right? So usually we have these moments of insight when we're not pounding away at the problem. We have them when we're quiet, or at least when we're defocused. So we start with focus by filling up our brains with information, and then we go away and we defocus. This is where meditation can be very helpful. And all of those parallel processors in your brain, all that thinking that you're not aware of, it has the ability to connect far more processes than your top-down consciousness. Remember, your top-down consciousness is only aware of at most 3 to 7, maybe 10 concepts at once. But your bottom-up parallel processors, they can, you know, you're not aware of what they're doing, but they can handle the information from millions of different processes. So they're much better enabled to put the pieces of the puzzle together. So by filling up your brain with all the information, you've primed them to solve the problem. And by doing so in a way that you're not too stressed, but you're stressed enough to want to solve it, you got to motivate these things, then while you're quiet, a lot of the work gets done. So the next step is to sit back and be quiet and listen. Just like we need to listen to each other to brainstorm in a meeting, We need to be quiet and listen to ourselves when we're trying to solve a problem. And you will have a lot of ideas pop up. The trick here is not to throw them out, not to analyze them. You'll do that later. Trust yourself. You're going to do it later. But right now, after you've been quiet for a while, let it do the work, let the ideas bubble up, and they will. And just think about them. Don't write them down. Just stay cool. Just let them go. Let them boil. And then after 20 minutes or so, then you go and you, if you take a, I use great big pieces of paper and whiteboards and things to write them all down. Just write them down. I'm still not judging them yet. Just get them all out there. And a lot of them are going to be dumb. But during this process, while you're having them boil up, you're going to be seeing ones that you're just going to want to jump out of your seat and go work on. You're going to have ideas that are awesome, but you got to let them all come. And then once you have them, now you go back into the focus. Now you go back into pounding your head up against the problem. And that's when Michelangelo starts sketching David. This is the thing. This is it. This is going to be my legacy, this giant, perfect carving of a perfect human being. That's the idea. And then it's how are you going to do it? You know, how are you going to make sure that when you miss with the hammer, that you don't destroy the whole thing? That's when all those solutions come together, and now you're back, you know, doing what we do, you know, in the United States so well, which is grind away and solve problems, work really hard and focus and push. But the trick to it is to goof off. You know, you have to do the hard part. You got to get all that information in your head, but it's just important that you go out and garden. Get into the garden. That's where the good work is going to happen. It is so hard to convince ourselves of that. I struggle with it. I live 40 minutes from just beautiful beaches. And when I go to the beach alone, and there's no one else there, they're cold, windy, foggy beaches. They're not like the stereotype Southern California beaches. So pretty much alone with the seals. And that's where all the great ideas come. But I still feel compelled to sit at the workstation and grind away. You know, it's got to break out and convince yourself that a lot of the hard work is really done when you're goofing off.
I had I have a brother-in-law who was an artist. He taught at Stout State University in Wisconsin, and he was a sculptor. And he told me that he, at one time, he told me that he set up regular hours for himself to go to his studio because he always got his really great ideas when he was walking around and he didn't have anything to create with when he was there. So he thought if he stayed in his studio, he'd have the ideas and he could create better. So that's an interesting change or change up on what you're talking about. Wouldn't necessarily work. The walking was part of the process, wasn't it?
Yeah. It really is. And my experience, you know, as a technologist writing software, doing physics research, and as well as writing novels, you know, two really opposite ends or seemingly opposite ends of the creativity spectrum. But getting away from the problem, and that's where all the great ideas come from. I just got to carry around a little notebook so that, you know, those ideas don't completely slip away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's just totally fascinating. I think I could talk with you a majority of the day. As you were talking, I was thinking, you must be really fun to have at parties, especially parties where people want to talk about things like, how does my brain work? But we've had the opportunity to have you at our party today, and you've made understanding the processes of and prejudice and fine points of our brains really fun. And I just want to tell you, I so thoroughly enjoyed reading The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs, that I'm going through a change now. I'm about to turn 74. I'm selling my home. I'm buying a van and taking off across the country. And temporarily, I'm living with my son in Davis, California. And I was so taken with the many humorous and down-to-earth ways that you were talking about the brain that I made him sit and listen to me for quite a number of minutes, more times than I'll admit to, because I just thought it was so well written and you know, I love the story, for example, and we'll leave this for you who are listening to find out on your own, of going into the bar to get a beer and slowly realizing that your mother is in the bar as well. Yeah, I like that one. So your book is chock full of scientifically based descriptions and processes and explanations, but you put it in everyday terms, and also with humor that you've been demonstrating today. So thank you for helping us better understand ourselves in the most basic ways through your writing and through your appearance here on Full Power Living today.
Well, thank you so much, Eileen. It's very, very kind of you to say those things. I really appreciate it. And, you know, as an author, I just love it when someone gets what I'm trying to do. And I really appreciate it. You made my day. Very sweet
Great.
Of you.
Great.
Have a nice travel. Boy, yeah, and you're in a very nice place. I love Davis. It's the flat part of California, but it's in the big valley. So it's all
right.
Got the hills around it. It's fantastic.
Right.
Especially this time of year when it's not too hot.
Plus, I'm being well taken care of. My son and daughter-in-law say as long as I do dishes, I can stay there. So. Okay. Thank you again. You can find Ransom Stevens on the web at ransomstevens, STEPHENS.com. And the title of his book is The Left Brain Speaks, The Right Brain Laughs. Next week, enjoy your Thanksgiving. And on Thursday, December 1st, listen again to Full Power Living at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, when I talk with Stan Goldberg about loving, caring for, and supporting someone with cancer. And remember, if you can't be with us in person, listen to our archives on emotionalpro.com or subscribe to Full Power Living on iTunes. Full Power Living's producer is Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.